This is Science Cafe
on BBC Radio Wales.
Shiva's Beach, dawn. As the sun rises, a bunch of just-hatched turtles, each shorter than my thumb, scamper like reptilian puppies to the sea. After they reach the ocean safely, I strip and swim in new turtle water to wash off the sand. Alfred, I half expect to see you straggling out of the scraggly forest in need of a bath in English-speaking company.
In 1854, Alfred Russel Wallace set out on a specimen-collecting expedition across the Malay archipelago. It was while recovering from a fever on a remote Indonesian island that he wrote his famous essay on natural selection as the mechanism of evolutionary change. It would later be published in tandem with Charles Darwin's theories on evolution. My guest on Science Cafe this week has spent 40 years retracing the steps of Wallace in Southeast Asia. I'm Adam Walton, and I'll be talking to explorer and conservationist Paul Spencer Serhushevsky, who has visited the exotic islands where the Welsh-born naturalist Wallace made so many of his remarkable discoveries. In the past decade, there has been a huge push to get recognition for the Monmouthshire-born naturalist, biologist and explorer Alfred Russel Wallace. While most of us recognise Charles Darwin's role in understanding evolution, until recently, Wallace's efforts have been largely forgotten by the general public. We hope to help redress the balance on our programme this week. There's a new book which focuses on Wallace's travels in Southeast Asia. It's called An Inordinate Fondness for Beetles. You heard the author reading from the book at the very beginning of the programme, and he joins me now. Welcome to Science Cafe, Paul.
Thank you, Adam. Pleasure to be here.
Now, Paul, if you could, tell us a little bit about your route into writing this particular book. When did you first become interested and aware of Alfred Wallace?
If you go back to 1969... It was the period of the Vietnam War, and I was just finishing university. And like a lot of young men at that time, we wanted to try to do something useful and see the world at the same time. And I entered the U.S. Peace Corps. So I became a volunteer in Sarawak, one of the Malaysian states on the island of Borneo. And then I continued to work in Singapore and Indonesia in advertising. And I realized quite early on that inadvertently, I was following Wallace's footsteps. I was living in the same place as he was. I was interested in similar issues, and I became interested in him as a man. And I thought, let's make a conscious effort to follow him and perhaps write about it.
And what prompted that realization that you were following his footsteps? Had you been reading about him before the journey, or were there signifiers while you were there? Was he someone who was recognized and celebrated in that particular area of Asia?
No, he was heartily unknown. He was known to biologists. He was known to conservationists. The general people had little idea of who he was and his impact on the area. So it was through talking to conservationists and various scientists that his name popped up, and I bought his book, The Malay Archipelago, and we were off.
I imagine it helps that he was a charismatic figure in many respects. In fact, I think that you describe in the book, he'd be the first person that you would invite to a dinner party. It might not surprise listeners, knowing that you've written a book about Wallace, that you would invite him to a dinner party. But you believe him, for example, to be far more fascinating and rounded than Darwin.
You know, comparisons are difficult, but I find Wallace to be a wonderfully complex man. He was interested in so many different things. He was a deep thinker. He was courageous. He was outspoken. And look at the scope of his interests. He was interested in why there are so many different creatures, so many different species, how they got there, how they evolve. He was interested in how islands have different biologies, different biodiversity from each other. He was interested in the movement of people and different races of people. He was interested in what at the time was called savage people's culture and made comments that were surprising at the time. For example, he was saying, well, if I'm staying in a a headhunter's village, I feel much more safe than if I was staying in an English city. Hmm. That you can leave your door open, there's little crime, and if there is any problem, it's settled amicably by consensus. He was interested in passion, and I think, Adam, this is an interesting point to distinguish him from other scientists of the period. Wallace was a scientist, a collector, a taxonomist, but in many places in the book, he talks about the thrill, the physical thrill of finding a new species of butterfly or beetle. Mm. He says he trembled with excitement. He had a headache that wouldn't go away all day because of the thrill of capturing a beautiful new insect. And I rather like that about him, Adam, that he wasn't afraid to expose himself in that way.
Yeah, there's a great emotional resonance to his science, in inverted commas. And I think that, I remember reading On the Origin of Species as part of an English degree that I did, and it's a very dry work. It's not much to get excited about or to feel enthused by. And yet, Wallace's writings are more, or at least as much a travelogue, partially an adventure story, as well as being authoritative scientific works as well.
Well, his book remains one of the great travel books for anyone visiting Southeast Asia.
There is also an element, I suppose, of an adventure story. Well, very much an element of an adventure story to his writings and his experiences as well. Is that another reason why you felt so engaged by his writings?
You know, he was out there on his own. He had no government support. He had no military support. He had no political support. Unlike Charles Darwin, who went around the world on the Beagle. And I'm not saying his voyage was always easy, but he was on the Beagle. He had a support system. He had a floating hotel. He had military support. He had a cabin where he could do his work and keep his specimens. He had a cook. He had cleaners. And his voyage was of a different scale than Wallace's, because Wallace went out as a poor individual. He was traveling on his own, living only by the money that he could make by selling specimens back in England. And that led to all sorts of difficulty in traveling. Sometimes he had to pay people to build him a boat. Sometimes he had to scrounge around to find a crew. Sometimes the crew deserted him, sometimes the boat sank in the middle of the ocean, and so on. And his travels were of a different scale, let's say a different dimension.
Is this one of the reasons why the style of the book that you've written is part biography, part travelogue? I would imagine it mirrors, in some aspects, the style of Wallace's original writings.
I tried several ways to write the book. I first tried writing it as a buddy book on the road with Alfred, where I was making up dialogue for him, and that didn't work. And then I created a new structure where it's my story, my adventures, my learnings, compared with his written observations, plus a bit of speculation, what would actually happen if I met him, if he were to come back today.
And you mentioned that he was a passionate collector. He collected over 125,000 specimens on his various journeys. But there were also great hiccups to that, weren't there? Was he not shipwrecked? Did he not lose an awful lot of one of the collections that he took over a period of years?
That's a fascinating incident in his life that would have broken many other people. Let me set the stage for you. He had a friend in England named Henry Walter Bates, and they used to go out beetle collecting in the English countryside. At the age of 23, without ever having left England, without having any money, without having any government support, without having formal education, they said, hey, let's go to the Amazon. Now, that was completely nuts. They didn't speak Portuguese. They didn't know anyone. And you've got to admire these two young guys saying, let's go to Brazil. After 4 years on the upper Rio Negro River, where Wallace was collecting thousands of new species, he took them with him on a brig called the Helen. Now, the Helen was a falling apart ship, and one morning off the coast of Bermuda, the captain knocked on Wallace's door and then said, excuse me, Mr. Wallace, we seem to have a bit of a problem. The ship's on fire. And Wallace grabbed a few notebooks, a couple of specimens. He grabbed a live parrot that he wanted to take back to England. And with the crew, they spent 10 days almost dying in a lifeboat before they were rescued. They finally made it back to England. Wallace swore never to get on another ship as long as he lived, and most people would have left it at that. Wallace said, no, I have to get back on the horse. I have to do something again. He applied to the Royal Geographical Society and got a grant to go to Southeast Asia. And you've got to admire that as well in the guy, because he had the pluck, he had the drive to do it again.
That's remarkable. Does he detail his emotional response at all to the sinking or watching that particular ship go down?
Well, in other books he does, yes, in other writings. And in spite of him losing his notebooks and his specimens, he managed to write two reasonably good books about the Amazon experience. One is The Palms of the Rio Negro, and one is Exploration on the Rio Negro. And to think about that, how could you write two books without having your source materials? So just for that alone, that ability and that, well, what would you call it, stick-to-itiveness, you've got to admire the guy.
Inevitably, and we've done it so far during this programme, and whenever we've covered Wallace, there's almost a dichotomy drawn between him and Charles Darwin, and you know, that's just an inevitable part of this story, isn't it? And yet Wallace's story does sound so much more engaging. So why the disparity, Paul?
I'm a foreigner. I'm American. And I don't quite understand the British class system. But if you look at Darwin and his two best friends, Charles Lyell, the geologist, Joseph Hooker, the botanist, director of Kew, they represented the establishment. They were the eminence grise. They were top of the pops. And Wallace came from a middle-class background. His father was a failed solicitor. The family never had any money. His mother was a teacher. Wallace left school at the age of 13, which makes his story even more spectacular. And Wallace wanted to work with them and be acknowledged by them.
And was that the case? Was the validity of his work on natural selection recognised by his peers? Because, again, you know, a rather easy interpretation on occasions that I've heard is that Darwin, in inverted commas, stole some of his ideas or, you know, kind of purloined them. Is there any truth to that?
Shall we talk another 2 hours?
Yes. Lifting the lid on an ant's nest, I imagine.
Okay. Two things. First of all, during Wallace's lifetime, he did achieve great recognition in the UK and was given all sorts of awards. So his contributions were recognized while he was alive. The relationship with Darwin is complex, and like many of these things, we can never know what's going on in the minds of people. We only have a written record. Wallace had written about evolution and natural selection in several papers before he went to Indonesia and while he was in Malaysian Borneo. When he went to eastern Indonesia in Ternate, he famously had a malaria dream, and he came up with the theory of evolution by natural selection. He wrote a 10-page paper to Darwin. And Darwin was a pen pal. Darwin wasn't a close friend, but Darwin was the go-to guy. He said, if you think it has validity, please show it to Charles Lyell. Now, Darwin is sitting in Downhouse. Darwin never left the UK again after the voyage of the Beagle. And one can imagine Darwin saying, you know, this guy has it. Up to that point, Darwin had not published one word on evolution. He had thought about it. He had written letters about the subject. He had not published. And in science, publishing and going public is everything. Darwin went to Lyell and Hooker and said, what do I do? And Lyell said, well, we told you some time ago that you should publish and go public. There was a special meeting of the Linnaean Society, here in Piccadilly. And Hooker and Lyle presented an unpublished short letter from Darwin to an American botanist, Asa Gray, and some unpublished short notes by Darwin. And they read into the proceedings this fully thought out 10-page academic paper written by Alfred Russel Wallace, which was ready for publication. And that's an interesting point. If Wallace had sent the paper to one of the scientific journals instead of sending it to Darwin, things would have been quite different.
It seems, astonishingly unfair from the lens of the present day. And as you mentioned, I mean, there's many hours of discussion and perhaps a serial dramatisation to be taken out of this, I'd imagine, Paul. You're listening to The Science Cafe on BBC Radio Wales, and this week we're talking to the author of a new book about Alfred Russel Wallace, the Monmouthshire-born naturalist and co-discoverer with Charles Darwin of the theory of natural selection, although we might have just poo-pooed that idea somewhat. The book, titled An Inordinate Fondness for Beetles, has been written by explorer and author Paul Spencer Sierhaszewski. And he's with us now, and he followed Wallace's footsteps as he travelled the Malay archipelago. The book includes Wallace's own notebook writings and includes this extract.
It is a melancholy fact that many of our fellow creatures do not know what is a beetle. They think cockroaches are beetles. Tell them that beetles are more numerous, more varied, and even more beautiful than the birds or beasts or fishes that inhabit the earth, and they will hardly believe you. Tell them that he who does not know something about beetles misses a never-failing source of pleasure and occupation and is ignorant of one of the most important groups of animals inhabiting the earth, and they will think you are joking. Tell them further that he who has never observed and studied beetles passes over more wonders in every field and every copse than the ordinary traveller sees who goes round the world, and they will perhaps consider you crazy, yet you will have told them only the truth.
Now, that was an extract from Wallace's own notebooks there. And Wallace was obsessed with beetles, wasn't he, Paul? Is that, I imagine, how the book, your book, got its title?
Yeah, the most common form of wildlife in the world are beetles. And the title comes from the British biochemist J.B.S. Haldane. And he was an ardent Marxist who quit England for India. And he was once asked by a distinguished theologian what inferences could be drawn about the nature of the Creator from the study of his creation. Haldane replied that God has an inordinate fondness for beetles. And I thought that would be an appropriate title, because Wallace was infatuated by beetles, partly because their variety and coloration and number, but also because they made money for him. Hmm. The British collecting public at that time, they had cabinets of curiosities, the museums had collections, and people really loved beetles. And Wallace survived by selling beetles and butterflies and birds and orangutans.
He also identified the faunal divide, which is now termed the Wallace Line, separating the Indonesian archipelago into two distinct parts, a western portion in which the animals are largely of Asian origin, and an eastern portion where the fauna reflects Australasia. Did you see those changes yourself, evidence of that divide when you visited that part of the world, Paul?
Absolutely, it's very clear. You just have to take the boat between Bali and Lombok, for example. On the western side of the divide, you have monkeys, great apes, hornbills, wild cattle, tigers, the dipterocarp trees. On the eastern side, which is, let's call it the Austronesian side, you've got eucalyptus, you've got ground birds like the cassowary, you've got birds of paradise, you've got cockatoos, and you can clearly see a divide, not only in the flora and fauna, but you can see a divide racially among the people.
It's a huge archipelago, isn't it? I mean, I'd imagine, although I'm speculating slightly here, is it not the largest archipelago in the world, the Indonesian archipelago?
Yes, more than 17,000 islands, and it stretches a distance roughly from London to Istanbul.
That's quite wide-ranging, isn't it? Now, one of Wallace's prime objectives, as I understand it, in visiting Southeast Asia, was to collect orangutans. How does one collect orangutans? Because that sounds like a parlous exercise, especially for an individual. or did he have help, Paul?
One collects an orangutan by shooting it.
Right.
And he often would go off and shoot a mother, shoot an orangutan. It sometimes turned out to be a mother who was nursing a baby. And he shot 17 orangutans all in Sarawak, in Malaysian Borneo. And in one famous section of the book, he takes about 8 pages to write about how when he shot the mother fell, and he found that the baby she was nursing was still alive, and he tried to nurse the baby back to health. And he went from being this cold-hearted collector, hunter, whatever you call him, to being a soppy Hallmark card-like father figure, nursing this cute little baby that he said is like the most adorable baby anybody could possibly imagine.
Because there's a great contrast of tones, as you say, isn't there? We'll actually hear an extract from that particular part of the book.
On May the 2nd, I again found one on a very high tree, when I had only a small 80-bore gun with me. However, I fired at it, and on seeing me, it began howling in a strange voice like a cough, and seemed in a great rage, breaking off branches with its hand and throwing them down, and then soon made off over the treetops. I did not care to follow it, as it was swampy and in parts dangerous, and I might easily have lost myself in the eagerness of pursuit.
This talk of hunting perhaps might offend modern sensibilities, but it was a very, very important part of Wallace's work, wasn't it? But also of the Victorian urge to collect trophies. But it's, you know, one of the positive outcomes of that is that we do have these vast collections of specimens.
You know, when the baby eventually died, and Wallace being Wallace and being, as I said, a bit complex, he did what he needed to do. He skinned the corpse and sold it to a museum, I think the Derby Museum in England.
Did your travels in Indonesia give you an insight into how Wallace collected his thoughts on evolution? Was it working with the apes or was it something more subtle?
Working with orangutans was part of it. He was curious about their cognitive ability, but he was very struck by the variety of birds, insects, other animals, and he was struck by some curiosities like the flying squirrel. You know, couldn't quite fly, but it had a great leaping ability because of adaptation, which gave him large foot pads, able to soar between the trees. And he was wondering why animals like that develop those kind of behaviors through biological changes. And I think it was just by collecting and looking and being a keen observer that he was able to develop his theory of natural selection.
How would he fit in to modern zoology, as it were? Because it sounds as if he was polymathic and was thinking about things in much broader terms than perhaps just specific scientific disciplines. He was thinking beyond biology and botany, and clearly if he was thinking about animal behaviour, but also anthropology as well, lots and lots of different aspects. Would he have fitted in the modern world where things do tend to be a little bit more focused and have to be focused on very particular disciplines?
No, I think he would have gone the other way. I think he would have become a conservationist in the sense of recognizing that life is, all things are interconnected. I think he would have recognized that if you mess around too much with one part of an ecosystem, it affects things elsewhere.
It's surprising just how much influence Wallace has had around the globe. I think rather presumptuously at the start of the programme, we said we're aiming to redress the balance here. I think everyone who talks about Wallace, any time a programme is made, there is almost an evangelical aspect to it, wanting to remind people of his work and bring his work to attention. Do you think that he's getting more of the attention than he deserves now, Paul?
Absolutely. When I was first writing the book 20 years ago, there were relatively few modern books about Wallace. I remember going to the Natural History Museum bookstore. Not only didn't they have books about Wallace, they weren't quite sure who he was. And I'd say in the last 20 years, there must be at least 20, 25 pretty good biographies of Wallace and descriptions of and discussions about Wallace's place in the history of science. I try to take that a step further by combining it with my own personal explorations and interests. So I think Wallace, yes, is enjoying a bit of a renaissance, a bit of a... People are starting to relook at Wallace's achievements, and I think that's all to the good.
Now, we're talking to you today because, well, Wallace is a fascinating character, but also, obviously, your new book as well, An Inordinate Fondness for Beetles, which is out now on Explorer's Eye Press. And we really should have, I think, another reading from the book before we sadly part company, Paul. So would you mind obliging us?
Shiva's Beach, between late and later. I wait for turtles. They will come. I scan the beach, trying to decide which direction to walk. A burst of heat lightning screams through the light clouds, and I think I see someone approaching from the far side of the beach. Alfred, is that you? Good evening, Paul. Is it all right if I address you as Paul? Without another word, he sits next to me on the bleached log. For a long moment, we stare, in parallel, out toward the sea, a crescent moon illuminating a strip of surf. It's been a good trip, I say finally.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for sharing your time and your enthusiasm with us on this week's Science Cafe. It's been fascinating and it's an excellent read. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Adam, for having me.
That's it for this week's edition of the Science Cafe. I do hope you've enjoyed following in the footsteps of Alfred Russel Wallace and Paul as well. And Paul's book, An Inordinate Fondness for Beetles, is available now on Explorer's Eye Press. If you'd like to listen to this edition of Science Cafe or other recent editions, you can do so via the BBC's iPlayer radio app.